Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 15th of May. Our guest this hour works with a very interesting laboratory at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. It's the Landscape and Human Health Laboratory, and it was started in 1993 to study the relationship between people and the physical environment. They've done a great deal of interesting work on a study of horticulture and children's behavior and environments, and you'll be interested in some of their findings. We'll be speaking with someone who works at that center, but first let me tell you what prompted this hour's conversation. Rhonda was looking at various websites yesterday and was at the Guardian website, the British newspaper, and found this study that was released yesterday having to do with depression and looking at the link between country walks, which can bring startling reductions in depression and also raise self-esteem. The charity study, Ecotherapy, the Green Agenda for Mental Health, is the first to look at how green exercise affects those suffering from depression. And it looked at a 30-minute walk in the country with a walk in an indoor shopping center on a group of 20 people who work with mind associations. After the country walk, 71% reporting decreased levels of depression, saying they felt less tense. We got to just stop the radio and I'll go for a walk here. That'd be a good idea. 90% saying that they had increased self-esteem. And this was in contrast to only 45% who experienced a decrease in depression after the shopping center walk, after which 22% said they actually felt more depressed. There's some interesting things going on around the world, and I think that maybe the Netherlands is at the cutting edge in all of this. The Netherlands has this program where people who are having mental difficulties are prescribed agricultural work, and they have 600 farms that are operating as a fully integrated part of the health service, which is a new concept, certainly in other parts of the world. So we're going to talk about all of this and about the studies that have been done at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and welcome your phone calls as well. Our number is 800-486-8655. Dr. Andrea Faber-Taylor is our guest, postdoctoral research scientist in the Landscape and Human Health Laboratory at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She draws on her education and experience in horticulture, design, and environment and behavior, and conducts research generating systematic evidence of the developmental benefits of green space for children. And she has focused on two subpopulations, children living in impoverished public housing and children who are coping with ADHD. Dr. Faber-Taylor, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me to be on your show.
What do you think of that study that was released yesterday from the University of Essex?
I think it's great. I think that we need more research like that. I looked at it a little bit. It looks like it's not clear how well they controlled for all the possible variables that could have influence their outcomes, but I think they definitely did a good job and are on the right track, and we should take that very seriously.
Yeah. So
it's exciting.
Is this a whole new field? I know that your center was started in 1993, this whole field of what green spaces do for those who have mental health problems and those who have live in poverty, those who have attention deficit disorder. Is this a whole new field?
Relatively new. I would say it originated in the 70s, really. So compared to other forms of psychology, our field would be maybe labeled environmental psychology.
Mm-hmm.
So compared to psychology as a whole, environmental psychology is relatively young. And in the last 15 years or so, there's been a great increase in the number of studies being done looking at the benefits of contact with nature for humans and people trying to really test that idea empirically and control all the other variables that might influence the outcome.
Mm-hmm. So, tell me about the work that you've done with children from impoverished neighborhoods and also children with ADHD.
We've done research in Chicago public housing looking at children living in very dire situations. And the reason we looked at that setting was, it's sad, but it's a relatively controlled it's almost like an experiment already set up where almost everything is the same for children living in these housing developments except for the amount of green space outside their home. And that it's just the way it has occurred because over the years the trees and grass have died in some of the courtyards, but other courtyards it's continued. And so looking at that, looking at children in that setting kind of helps to control for all the other variables that might impact their outcomes. And so we compared children living in housing or in apartment buildings with green space right outside their building compared to children living in buildings that are have a barren space outside. And it was so interesting, all the variables that we measured, children who had the green space outside or who were in the green space when we measured them were doing better, significantly better. And it was almost shocking. And it's encouraging. Doing research there is encouraging because it is such a, it's like an experiment. It's sad, but that's, everything is controlled for. So you can have a lot of confidence in that it isn't some other factor like their parents being, there's something unique about the child's parents or something that made them better off. So that's one group that we've looked at, and it really, the evidence is very consistent, and it says over and over, the kids with green space outside the home are doing better, and really need to make sure that when they have to live in that kind of a setting where, you know, there's obviously a lot of difficult things going on, at least we could be planting trees outside those apartment buildings and a little bit of grass, because it wasn't very much. It wasn't like it was a lush green environment outside their home, the ones who had the green space and were doing better. It was usually just a few trees, mature shade trees, and a little bit of grass.
Interesting.
And so it was just, it's stunning for us, you know, to see this, to see the pattern. So we've been encouraging and policymakers to consider that and to plant more trees where they can, especially in public housing, because it does make a difference, and it means that those children are going to be better off and have a better chance of getting out of public housing and out of their impoverished environments and moving on.
Wow, that's saying a lot. So, and do you have to spend time in the green space, or is it okay to just look at it?
We have studies with findings from both. Some of the studies, we just measured their views from their apartment and how much of that view was green, and found a correlation between how they scored on measures of concentration, impulse control, and delay of gratification. And the ones who had the greener the view, the higher they scored on those measures. And we checked for, you know, there's really no difference in the parents in terms of education level or economic status or anything. And that is very, very surprising, but that's what we found. So it makes sense when you look at some of the theories behind it. Let's see. I'm talking about children in public housing, and I guess I want to talk a little bit, too, about the children with ADHD study.
Sure.
Do you want me to talk
about
that?
Yeah, go right ahead. Sure.
Another population that we've been looking at has been children with ADHD. And for them, we've been wondering, in the general population, we see that there's research showing that people with regular attentional functioning do function better, are better able to pay attention and so forth after time in green settings. And so we thought, okay, children with ADHD, here's a population who are in desperate need of support. They need alternatives to finding ways to coping with their symptoms and trying to improve their symptoms, even in small amounts. So we thought, well, perhaps this is true for them as well. Perhaps that if children with ADHD spend time in green settings, they're better off, at least for a little while afterwards. And so we've started conducting studies on this and found, again, a strong relationship between where they spend their time and how they're doing immediately afterward. So this is encouraging and suggests that perhaps something as simple as making sure that children who have ADHD go out and spend time in a green setting, you know, maybe a park or even a very green backyard, if they do that every day, they might be able to help themselves a little bit in coping. So,
And why is that important? Do you know why green space affects children and adults, according to this University of Essex study, the way it does?
One theory that we base all our research on, and I think it's a very good theory that explains a lot, is Stephen Kaplan. He's at the University of Michigan and the Department of Psychology. He's developed a theory called attention restoration theory, and it's a complex theory. I can try to explain it in a nutshell.
Okay.
I think it's very interesting, and I think people will find it interesting and applicable to their own lives. What he says is, or he points out, that we have two forms of attention, directed attention and involuntary attention. And directed attention is what we use almost all the time when we're trying to stay on task and tune out distractions and do something that's not inherently interesting to us, but we know we've got to do it, you know, like our work or taxes or, you know, there's lots of things in everyday living. The trouble with directed attention, though, is that it's a finite capacity and it fatigues with use. So we're all using this and then we're using it up. And I think we can all relate to that. You know, at the end of a hard day of work, we might say, especially maybe if you've been taking an exam or filing taxes or driving in heavy traffic, you might say, I feel fried or trashed or whatever. So, you know, where you just feel a little bit numb mentally and not able to even make simple decisions or focus very well on anything. And that's because your direct attention capacity is used up. And Kaplan's theory is that the best way to restore our attention from fatigue is to not use directed attention, but instead to switch to using our involuntary attention.
Huh.
And only certain activities and environments draw on that involuntary attention. And it's an easy form of attention, and it doesn't require any effort. And certain things like fire and babies and wildlife and
puppies.
Moving water, all these things draw on our involuntary attention. And you can relate to that, you know, how easy it is to watch a campfire for a long time.
Yes,
you don't
yes.
have to force yourself to
right.
do that.
Right.
And that's drawing on your involuntary attention. Meanwhile, directed attention is resting and restoring from fatigue. So the theory is that certain environments have, he names four characteristics that help us use more or rely more on our involuntary attention and thereby rest our directed attention and restore.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes good sense. And he's looked at things, a lot of things involving nature and a little bit on meditation and other activities. So that's the theory behind it, that,
mm-hmm.
that maybe when we are in natural environments, it has so many of the characteristics that foster using our involuntary attention that we are thereby resting our directed attention and restoring ourselves mentally.
Mm-hmm.
From fatigue.
I was very interested. I had never heard this before, and actually my brother lives in Holland. I'll have to ask him about this. Patients in Holland, they have 600 farms, and they use them to treat mental distress. Patients are prescribed agricultural work. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not very familiar with that, with that work, but that's, it makes sense. I think, in theory. I'm not sure about the physical labor part of it, but certainly being out of a city, getting out of a city, if that's the point, if it's taking people out of a city and putting them in an agricultural setting,
mm-hmm.
that seems like a very good opportunity for restoration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's also the work component probably plays a role in that. I think that physical labor, you know, like on a farm, or gardening or other activities like that helps us to have a sense of satisfaction and you can see that you've accomplished something, you can see a change. I think that there's a lot of variables that play into that.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, just on a personal, totally personal level, I have a really tiny backyard, but I can't tell you how important that backyard is to
mm-hmm.
me. Every single day, you know, to see what's growing now, to see what's coming out,
yeah.
to just sit
yeah.
there
uh-huh.
and look at the, you know, the pine tree and the flowers that are there and the
right.
tomatoes and all of that. It's just a precious space.
Right. Yeah.
It's not very big at all.
Right. It doesn't take much, apparently.
Yeah.
And it may go back to, you know, Kaplan talks about four characteristics of restorative environments. And one of them is that it has extent. And that doesn't mean it has to be physically large, but it has to have extent in terms of our minds and feeling like you... how can I explain this? So, like, you're focusing on all the layers, and you have small plants and larger plants, and it feel mentally you feel like you are in a different place that has depth to it. Maybe even though it's a very physically small space, probably you have large trees
right.
that surround it and kind of screen you from other neighbors
right.
or something.
Right.
It's
interesting. Let's pause for a moment and return. We are talking about. Our guest has talked about it as environmental psychology, and so it's kind of a new area. At least to me, it's very new. Some of you may know a great deal about it. Our conversation prompted by a study that was released yesterday, Ecotherapy. It was released in Great Britain, the Green Agenda for mental health, and it looked at how green exercise affects those who are suffering by depression, the study done by the University of Essex. Our guest has done a lot of work with people in children who have ADHD and also children who are living in impoverished neighborhoods and looking at the effect in terms of well-being, ability to concentrate if there is green space. She is at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and we're welcoming phone calls for Dr. Andrea Faber-Taylor, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls now for our guest, 800-486-8655. Cindy is our first caller from Menominee, Wisconsin. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I just wondered if it sounds like you've done a lot of studies on this, and perhaps you were responsible for another study that had to do with urban low-income housing. It was very, the results were very strong in the high-rise apartment buildings where there were trees or grass around the buildings. I believe the study showed a lower incidence of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of that?
I was not directly involved in that study, but that came from our lab, I would think. Our lab's done research on that. It was Chicago Public Housing, and they looked at crime rates, the police records, and compared to the level of greenness in the courtyards surrounding the buildings, and did find lower rates, significantly lower rates of property crime and violent crime in the buildings that had green space right outside.
Well, it just seems like something that we should focus on, you know, remedying if we could do something so simple as plant some
right.
Trees.
That's how we feel. And I think that communities are starting to recognize this. I've seen an encouraging increase in interest from municipalities and so forth that are looking at the research, not just our research, but there's other groups doing this kind of research as well, and they're realizing, hey, planting trees is not that expensive in the grand scheme of things, and maybe we need to pay more attention to this. And certainly in Chicago, Mayor Daley has really gotten excited about this idea that trees and green space are valuable and beneficial to people, and in the last, 6 or 7 years has really gone nuts, I guess you could say, with planting trees. He's and greening and adding planters and on Michigan Avenue and so forth.
Yes.
And has really spent a lot of money on greening Chicago, and that's been really neat to see. And he was very interested in the research our lab did and the findings. So I think he took it very seriously and said, yes, this is something we need to do. And there's lots of other cities across the U.S. that there's a council of mayors that meets every year, and they talk about these things, and urban forestry is something that they've been seriously considering and talking about, and Dr. Francis Kuo and Dr. William Sullivan from our lab have gone and talked to that council and advised on these things. So it's very encouraging.
Thank you so much for the call. In Milwaukee, we've had our problems keeping our parks looking good, but Milwaukee had this whole series of socialist mayors, as you know, back in the early part of the 20th century, who decided that green space was very important for, you know, just the health of people living in cities. And
yeah.
So until recently, we still have terrific parks, but there are parks all over this city, and it makes a huge difference, I think, in the quality of life in a city and why people say some cities are very livable cities, right?
I agree. Another trend, though, that I've noticed is that even though we provide green space and nice parks, I think as a society we're not using them like we used to.
Right, you're right. Yeah,
and I think that's a real problem. People have become so accustomed to trying to pack more into their day and get more done, and I think that electronics have helped us and hurt us in that. We try to do more and more and more because we have all these faster ways of communicating and, you know, email and text messaging and all this. And we get so wrapped up in all of that, we forget that just putting it all down and going to the park and going for a walk without an iPod, without a cell phone,
right.
Is really beneficial and important. We've just forgotten, I think. And so there's a lot of groups out there, grassroots groups and research organizations that are starting to rally and say, hello, we need to remember that we need time outdoors and in green space, and you can't put it off once a year. A big dose once a year is just not enough. You need it almost every day, mm-hmm. I think, taking that time and investing in yourself.
Thanks, Cindy, for your call. Let's go to Ed from Madison next. Hi, Ed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is very interesting to me. By day, I'm an architect and design medical environments.
Oh.
And of course, there's been a great deal of progress and in focus in recent years on the idea of daylight and views to nature, whether they be real or mm-hmm. symbolic. A specialty area of that is healing gardens, which are becoming really incorporated in many hospital campuses and so on, mm-hmm. because there's clear evidence that they improve outcomes. On the personal front, my very high needs 8-year-old son has, from an early age, shown that he can function considerably higher when we are down in the park, particularly fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an object lesson in the importance of that environment. To me, it makes perfect sense because from an evolutionary standpoint, it's simply putting us back in the environment that we are evolved to be functional in.
Yep.
And that you just don't take it away. If you do take it away, you're going to have dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And I see in the medical environments that what we can really demonstrate is that give back those cues to nature that everyone needs, the staff morale and functioning goes way up, which means happy patients and better outcomes and all of that.
Yeah.
But in the case of my son, who's multiple challenges, attention deficit is not really prominent there so much as all general sensory integration problems from early on and mood stability problems and other kind of processing issues. But in other settings where he'd be challenged to attend to something for 3 to 5 minutes, he showed, at age 4 already, an ability to fish for 3 to 4 hours.
Oh, my. Mm.
And be, and be totally comfortable. I mean, it truly was transforming to go out into that basically physically appropriate environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And he could be comfortable in his own skin in a way that was not possible indoors.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to share that.
That matches what I've heard other parents say, too. And that this is the repeating theme, especially fishing. Something around very relaxing about that process, I think.
I guess related to that, I would, just use this moment to pitch the idea that parents need to insist that their schools do not treat recess as optional.
Yes.
I agree with you. We got to do a show on that because mm-hmm. so many schools have done just that. It's optional.
Right, right.
That's right. Mm-hmm. We've had them in 2 schools. The previous school was very inattentive to the negative aspects of the environment. And whenever the reading block ran over in the morning, they'd just skip recess.
Oh, dear.
Mm-hmm. And his functioning would just plummet.
Mm-hmm.
And so, especially for kids with higher challenges, I think it's really vital. And it's good to see generally the awareness of that really kind of coming back.
Yeah. Thank you, Ed, so much for your call. I'm glad you were listening today.
Thank you.
We will do a show on recess. That reminds me. We go to Sue next from Toronto. Hi, Sue. Oh, Sue, we got a bad line here. Can we hear you?
I can hear you, but
I'll
pull over just a second. I'm on the highway.
Oh,
Sue. Sue.
I was waiting until you got to me.
Okay.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I was just calling because I am on the highway today, but I commute for about 40 minutes each day to and from Toronto to Green Bay through mostly rural landscape. So I'm wondering, how does that balance out? Because I've always felt the drive was kind of a de-stressing thing in some ways.
Mm.
So I'm going through like farm fields and things, and yet I'm doing a focused activity. So I take your answer off my phone since
I'm
on the road.
All right, Sue, thanks very much for the call.
So the question is, do I think that driving through farmland is restorative?
Yes.
Depends on probably on the amount of traffic and how much, if it's sometimes interstate driving, I think can actually be mentally relaxing. I don't know if it's fully restorative, but if you have plenty of room for error, you don't have cars coming directly at you, and you can, and there's not a lot of cars around you. I think I've experienced that I've been able to do a lot of reflective thinking, and I think that's a component of restoration is room for reflective thinking. At least that's what Kaplan talks about, that you can think big picture and long term and review the past and so forth. So certainly driving through a rural landscape is much more restorative than to drive through an urban landscape, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also this, and this phrase has been around for a long time, and people have done just this. Let's go for a drive in the country. Mm-hmm. Sunday afternoon. There must be something to it.
Yes, that's true. Must be restful in some way. Although, of course, now there's the campaign, turn your Sunday drive into a Sunday walk.
Yes, or bicycle ride,
the
exactly.
Yes, for yeah. them.
Now, tell me, do you have an actual center, the Landscape and Human Health Laboratory? Is this a center where you bring people or what?
We're a part of the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, and we're in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. We have a building that we call our own. We don't usually bring people to our building for research purposes. We go out into the community or use survey studies, or like when we did the Chicago research, we went to Chicago and conducted the research there in the public housing. So, no, we don't.
I see.
It's not like we're not a treatment center or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you should expand and build a whole series of places where people mm-hmm. can come, huh?
Well, yeah. That
if you build it, they will come.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Yep.
Laura from Vesper is next. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I just wanted to call and let you know about a brochure that I picked up last night. There's an event in Stevens Point coming up called Walk Wisconsin Naturally.
Mm.
And, Stevens Point for Wisconsin is, you know, the home of natural resources. At the university, we've got the College of Natural Resources there. And there's a fantastic trail system called the Green Circle Trail that loops around, anybody who likes to take a walk out in the country, this is a great place, but it's really a well-maintained trail. And this Walk Wisconsin, what I was really pleased to see is that it's non-competitive. So it's something to just encourage people to get out there and to walk and to enjoy. And they've got three different distances, and they allow, you know, 9 hours or 6 hours or 3.5 hours to finish the route. So I thought this would be something of interest to people who are listening today.
Yes, it sure would. Do you know where it starts, or is there a website or anything?
It's on June 2nd.
Okay.
In Stevens Point. There's a special event that Friday night, June 1st, for kids. But the website is
www.walkwisconsin.com. Walkwisconsin.com. Oh, that's great.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. We go next to Tom from Stoddard. Hi, Tom.
Hi, this is Tom. And I wanted to mention that in the 1970s, a book came out by Dr. John Ott.
Okay. You have a horrible hum on the phone. Can you get a little closer to the phone? It's very hard to hear you.
Okay.
Yeah.
The book came out in 1970 called Health and Light by Dr. John Ott.
Uh-huh.
E-T.
Okay.
And he points out that we need to get 2 hours of sunlight every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important because the sunlight comes into our eyes and it stimulates the pineal gland, which is between the brain and the eyes, and that controls the pituitary gland, which controls all the hormone production throughout the body.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Now, was this a medical doctor who wrote that, or how did he?
I can't remember his credentials, but he had the title of doctor, and he did a lot of research in photography early on. And the reason he came to realization of he discovered the whole idea of the full spectrum sunlight and the production of the full spectrum light bulb came
mm-hmm.
out of his research.
Mm.
And he was doing research on doing time-lapse photography on an apple as it blossomed, and then as it went to maturity, he had to box this apple within a a glass box that it wouldn't be moving around because he had to take a photograph every 15 minutes, I think. So he wanted to show the production of this apple throughout its history, and it got to the point where it should ripen, and it would not ripen. And he couldn't figure it out for a long time, but finally realized that the apple needed, the tree needed full spectrum sunlight to have that apple ripen.
Okay. I don't mean to cut you off, but that humming is driving me crazy. Dr. Faber-Taylor, have you done studies on light, too? Is light part of the picture here, green space and light?
We have not studied light. We haven't really. Certainly, sunlight and natural light is a part of nature. You can't separate those. We, in our research, in trying to boil down the variables, we've only actually measured the maybe tree canopy, the square footage or something to that effect, or people visually rate on a scale of 1 to 5 how green the view is compared to something else, and a built view or something. So we really just have boiled it down to trees and grass, which is not nearly all that's involved in quote nature, but that's in trying to keep our studies very tight and get as close as we can to a controlled study. That's what we've been doing. But other people have done research trying to capture all the variables, and I really think it's the whole set. It's not just
right.
People have said, well, is it about being green? Just looking at what if you painted your walls green? Is that enough? Is it the color green? And I don't think so. I think it's the light, it's the breeze, it's the change. As you said, watching plants change and move, and all of these factors influence us.
Except in theater, you go to the green room before the performance, right? To relax yourself. I mean, there must be something to that. Thanks very much, Tom, for the call. Peggy is next from Madison. And by the way, we have a couple lines open. Our lines have been crowded. 800-486-8655. We're talking about environmental psychology this hour of the program. 800-486-8655. Peggy from Madison, hi.
Hi, I'm so excited to hear this. I'm an early childhood special ed teacher in the Madison area, and I work with 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds who have ADHD, ADD, or maybe on the autism spectrum, or just have sensory integration difficulties. And more over the years, what I've been finding is that we're spending less and less time outside, and what we're doing is trying to help these children inside by creating artificial environments where they can bounce or hang or we'll put them up in a blanket and roll them around, or we'll do a crash and bang wall where it's just padded and they can run into it and fall down. And it seems to me like it's all the stuff that they do naturally outside. If they were able to be outside and do that, they roll down hills, they hang from trees. And the other thing that we are having trouble with is there are so many safety problems with playground equipment now. I saw a seesaw last week for the first time in I don't know how many years. So I'm seeing that these children are really needing desperately to be outside, not just also for the fresh air and the green space and to do some exploring, and but also for their bodies. Their bodies need to move. And as I'm watching student teachers come in who have been raised in preschools, that whole piece of the outside and the way that young children need to constantly be in motion in order to organize their brains for learning is missing, because these some of our younger teachers are in such a mindset that if we're outside for more than half an hour, we're really not using time for learning. I just wanted to put that in, and I'm so excited to hear this, and I hope that maybe this is a start of going back towards that. So thank you for this program.
You would be very interested in at North Carolina State University. There's a group called the Nature Initiative. Natural Learning is their
I can't think of their website. But if you went to the NC State website, you would find a link to their group, their research group, and they are promoting how to incorporate green space and developmentally supportive outdoor play spaces in childcare centers. And, in fact, they do an institute every summer. And I spoke at it last summer, and I'll speak again this summer. Huh. And this summer it's in West Virginia. But you would really appreciate the resources they have available. And they're very much about promoting how to get the resources you need and the information you need to incorporate more green space and outdoor time into daycare centers. So.
Oh, and they have a website? But
they do. I think it's www.naturalearning.org. It's the L at the end of the word natural also doubles for the L in the word learning. It's natural learning, but there's only one L in there.
Okay, thank you.
I think it's dot org. But
okay, thanks.
You're welcome. Or she can always go to North Carolina State, right?
Yes, I think their website.
Maneuver your way around
university
that.
Website. Uh-huh. We'll have it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also something she was talking about seesaws, and somehow we've thought that those are dangerous now. I think we're thinking that the outside is dangerous in some ways, aren't we?
Yep, there's a trend towards that too. There's so many concerns about how as a society we've become so focused on safety, which in many ways is good. It's reduced a lot of the accidental deaths in children over the last couple decades, but it's also seriously hampered children's access to the outdoors, and parents feel that they have to be with them every minute of the day, or someone has to be supervising the children. They don't have the free play that they used to have. They're not allowed to roam and explore,
right,
especially natural settings. There's the fear of abduction, which I believe the statistics show abduction rates actually haven't increased any, but our awareness of them because of national media and so forth makes it seem like there are more, but anyway, so there's this sad trend towards children's restrictions and access to outdoor environments and to natural environments. So,
and where did we get that? Is that where are we getting that?
Getting what?
Getting that fear.
That's what a lot of people are asking, and I don't know. Some people, of course, say, "Oh, it's the media." They overhype certain things, and I think it's more people as a whole, as a society, because there was a big push for increased awareness of safety. If you think in the 70s, we rode in cars without car seats, little children. Now, when I was a baby, my mom would just set me in a little thing on the floor of the car, in a little seat. I wasn't attached to the car in any way, and that seems crazy now, but people just didn't worry about it so much, and with all the increased attention and focus and training on car seats and bicycle helmets, and I'm not saying any of that is bad, because clearly the numbers of accidental deaths have gone down, and that's really important, but it's also kind of driven us to a mindset that anything that's at all risky, it must be bad, and we just can't do it at all, and I don't know.
Right.
I'm a parent of three children, and I struggle with that myself, how far to let them roam without my being with them, and how much do I let them experiment and climb.
Sure. We're going to welcome more phone calls in just a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. We're talking about environmental psychology. Our guest has described it as such. A University of Essex study came out yesterday comparing the benefits of a 30-minute walk in a country park with a walk in an indoor shopping center on a group of 20 members of the local Mind Associations, the mental health charity Mind. And the findings suggest that ecotherapy, they call it in England, should be prescribed by doctors to help treat mental health problems. As you know, the rate of antidepressant drug use is way up all over the world. The charity in England said the antidepressant prescriptions are at an all-time high, with 6% increase, the number written by general practitioners the year before. And so they're saying in this study, we're not saying that ecotherapy can replace drugs, but that the debate needs to be broadened. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Little Rock Nine, students attempting to enter Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, and we'll be looking at President Eisenhower's response where he sent in federal troops. It was in quite a year and quite a time in American history. The book, which is titled Ike's Final Battle, The Road to Little Rock and the Challenge of Equality, also looks at Eisenhower's views on race. And so the author of that book will be with us the second hour of the program today. All right, back to phone calls. Terry is next from Menasha. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I'm finding this program really interesting, and I'm even reflecting more as I was waiting for the call to come up. But I wanted to relate my own experience. I've noticed moving from house to house that when we've come to a new house, I'm always trying to get the windows open, get some light in, but there's no privacy. So I'm always craving to get something green in the window, you know, plant a tree here or there that I can open my house up and get some bird sounds, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to mention that I have major depression. I've been treated for that for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always finding this craving to see greenery out the window, to open the window and hear that. I'm thinking that the sound of the birds is an element in this.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the study that was done in Illinois, I wonder if birds came to those trees. Mm-hmm. But I'm always wanting to get the house open so I can hear the birds. I want to see the greenery. And then beyond that, when I'm in a new house, I'm always out. I want to go out in the yard. I want to create like a little area for myself that has greenery that I can be out there and just sit and look at the sky or listen to the birds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always this huge impulse for me every time we've come to a new home. And I just wanted to relate that because I think it's very much tied to my struggle with depression.
Mm-hmm.
And wanting to do better.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just my comment. And I wanted to mention about the element of the bird sound. She had talked about this idea of extension, and I'm wondering how the bird sound might be that same kind of a thing that it pulls you away somehow, changes your focus, you know, that kind of thing. And it's like this little element of surprise that that enters in there.
Mm.
So I just wanted to make those comments, and I'll get off the air then.
Thank you, Terry, very
Thanks
much for your call.
I would add that I think birds would add to the another component of restorative environments that Stephen Kaplan promotes is soft fascination, and I think birds would probably fall into that they draw our attention, but in a very soft way. It's sort of fascinating to hear the songs and how they change and so forth. But it doesn't. It's not riveting. It's not a. I guess the opposite would be hard fascination. And there's some speculation that maybe perhaps TV or a movie would be. That's easy to attend to as well. But it's not soft. It's hard. It's a riveting kind of attention fascination that doesn't allow you for any room to think or reflect. So yes, that's a good point. Birds are probably a key part of all of this.
Mm-hmm. John from Milwaukee is next. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. Really good show. I don't know if you're aware, but in Milwaukee, there was a sanitarium on Edgewood Avenue between Shorewood and Milwaukee called, I believe, the Edgewood Sanitarium, founded by a doctor named Studley back, I believe, in the teens or 20s of the last century. And, you know, that was his whole methodology. And he was, I guess, considered to be ahead of his time then. He planted an arboretum, basically.
Huh.
And it's still, part of it remains, but unfortunately the Village of Sherwood Board of Trustees and all of their wisdom decided to build condos on it, or allow condos to be built. And unfortunately, most of the trees now are gone, but there were trees from all over the world, actually. In fact, there are a couple of champion trees remaining there.
Huh.
I guess as much as I really appreciate this insight, part of me just wants to say, well, duh. I mean, you know,
right, we should know this.
Yeah.
Like, this is like a study that says that hugs from your grandmother are good for us.
I mean, yeah, I get that. I get that from time to time when I present my research, people come to me and they say, I don't see why you did this research. I could have told you this. And I say, well, yeah, but when you go to policymakers and you say you need to plant more trees because people will function better and our communities will thrive because of it, they say, show me the numbers. We want to see statistics. We want to know that it makes a difference in a measurable way, in an important way, like, you know, psychological functioning or people's ability to whatever. And it is frustrating, but that's the state of our society. We're, the dollars don't go where they need to go unless we have numbers to back it up. So.
Right. Well, and it is a whole new area, so that instead of going to a doctor and being treated for depression, you're going for a doctor who realizes the importance of these kinds of studies. Mm-hmm. So it's just a natural that you say, well, a combination of here's your medicine, but you also need to be outside more. You need to take walks.
Right.
No, but there aren't many doctors doing that.
Physical exercise, too. I think just the walking in itself. There's research that shows that, walking or exercising changes your brain chemistry for a little while after, endorphins kick in and so forth. So, yes, it does seem, it's one of those things where we just don't appreciate the fact if we just did what everybody knows, which is to eat, nutritious food and get adequate sleep and exercise every day and spend time in our, what's more normal for us, which is a natural setting instead of a highly built setting, we'd all be better off.
Right.
But we just don't want to hear that. We don't want to do that. We don't want to be disciplined in that way. We just,
Thank you, John. Thanks very much for the call. I didn't know that bit of Shorewood history. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Bob from Appleton. Hi, Bob.
Hi. It's a wonderful program. I wish I could have gotten my sister-in-law to call in. I just contacted her as soon as I heard this program was on. Her name is Patty, and she started a company, I think last year. It's called Earth Wonders, and it deals exactly with what you're talking about. I think her website is earthwonders.org or net. I really don't know, but I'm sure if you Googled it, you'd be able to find her. She's in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And if people wanted to contact her in Stevens Point, her number is 715.
Are you sure you want to give a phone number? Is that not a home phone number?
That is her company number.
All right.
It's 715-321-0227. And like I said, what she does is, in particular, I guess, is deal with corporations to help with productivity with nature programs. In that regard, and also with people in hospitals. So, like I said, I wish she could have called. She had another obligation, but I really wanted to put that out there because, as you said before, if they build it, they will come. And she's already started this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bob. Thanks so much for the call. Well, as I was driving in today, I was listening to National Public Radio News, and they were talking about a major conference in New York City of mayors from all over the world who are looking at the global warming issue, and this ties into that as well, right? To make sure that there are green spaces in cities, more trees in cities, is some way to combat global warming.
Yep. Yes, that's true.
So it's good for everything.
Right. And for a while, there's been look at the benefits of trees for rain runoff and soaking up all that extra water when you have so much of the earth paved and there's no place for that rainwater to go and be absorbed.
Right. So much of the earth is paved, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, huge chunks of it for cars.
Here in central Illinois, they're paving over. We have the richest soil, supposedly, in the world. I don't know about that, but very good farmland, and it's getting paved over at an alarming rate for housing that I don't know who buys these houses, but.
Right, for some of those McMansions, the three-car garage and the, Let's go next to Angela from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Angela.
Hi. I guess I'm going to tag on to the duh comment. I'm of Cherokee descent, and I think probably no people have been hit harder by being taken away from nature than our indigenous Indian peoples. I'm looking at all the crime and alcoholism and disease that are on the reservations from a people that were taken from their ancestral lands, taken from the nature, which is not just a tree to us. That's part of our culture and part of our spirituality. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing all my elders, listening to this. I know why people like to dissect things and study things and go to college for it. But most of my elders who barely have a elementary education would be saying, duh.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if any of this research might be hopefully targeted towards specific peoples, like our Indian people who thrive, who need to get back into the woods to heal themselves as a whole culture.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. We do need to do research on that. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Angela, we missed that.
Or I'm just wondering, can we use your research to, like, help apply for grants or anything to help get back to nature?
You can cite our lab's research, and there's other groups that have done research as well that you could cite. If you go to our website, that would be a good place to start, and you could email me as well. And then you can reference all this research in when you apply for grants to promote whatever programs or whatever you want to do.
Do you want to give us that information because we're out of time?
Okay. Do you want me to give our website?
The website would be great, yes.
Sure. It is www.lhhl.uiuc.edu.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us. What an interesting hour.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Yeah, it has been fun. Our guest, Professor Andrea Faber-Taylor, postdoctoral research scientist in the Landscape and Human Health Laboratory at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.